It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Think back to the last time you had a big test or exam to study for, whether it was years ago in high school or college or just last semester. How'd you get ready? Flashcards, practice tests, rereading your notes from class, maybe a little bit of everything. Our next guest says if we want to know what really works, we can look to psychology and how our brains actually retain information. He's looking mainly at school, but there are lessons here for learning at all levels, for work, fun, and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How did you study during your time in school? Did you take thorough notes? What did that look like? Did you pull the infamous all-nighter to get ready for the big exam? What worked for you? What didn't seem to work? If you're a student right now, how do you study? Do you study? Teachers out there, how do you encourage your students to study and prepare? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Regan Gurung is professor of psychology and director of the general psychology program at Oregon State University. He's director there of the Center for Teaching and Learning, and he's co-author, along with John Dunlowski, of the new book, Study Like a Champ, the Psychology-Based Guide to Grade A Study Habits. He's a former UW Green Bay professor. Regan, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be back, Rob.
Well, one thing that I learned from your book is I might have assumed that, you know, I'm either good at studying or I'm bad at studying, and there's not much I can do about it. The good news of your book, I think, is we can get better at it.
And that is, I think, a great place to start, because far too often, I think people have mindsets that go, I can do this, I can't do that. And I think most of us have probably heard now, whether it's math or something complex, instead of saying, I can't do that, or I'm not good at it, a good way to go is saying, I'm not good at it yet. And I think that's exactly what we set out to do in this book, is to say, look, even if you haven't had success before, here are some really clear-cut things you can do that can make you better at it. And it just takes some practice.
You start with some myth-busting and public myth number one, I think, the idea of learning styles. So we each have our own learning style, and we need to be taught and learn in a particular way. And this, a lot of people, I've thought this in my life. A lot of people that are listening right now, I'm sure, believe this. Regan, what does the research show?
So here's the big deal. I think I want to make clear the distinction between preferences and matching a teacher and students' learning styles. We all have preferences. We all have preferences for how we like to do things and learn things. But what the research looked at is it really important for the way a teacher teaches to match the preferred learning style of a student? And a very large study looked at all the research that was available and came to the conclusion that matching teaching style and learning style is not important. And in fact, we tend to learn better if we are exposed to different styles. So if you are somebody who goes, oh, I am a insert learning style here. Let's say I am a visual learner, but this person uses a non-visual style, therefore I can't learn. Well, nope, the research shows that's just not the case. So don't use that anymore. That learning style myth has been busted for some time now, but like you said, it's got some staying power. It's still out there. And every year I see the memes out there about learning styles. And I think we've got to remember, move on. You don't have to match learning styles.
That said, there are some things we need to understand about ourselves. And here's one that really hit me. You talk about the idea of a feeling of knowledge. And maybe at some point in everybody's school career, they had the thing like, hey, I got this. I'm ready to nail it. And then you don't nail it. You didn't know as much as you think you do. This is really important. How do we evaluate our feeling of knowledge of the upcoming test, say, versus where we really are?
Right. I think one big thing for us all to remember is that we are very good at deceiving ourselves. We are very good at deceiving ourselves, especially to make us feel better. And our cognitive processes aren't always a direct reflection of reality. So when we talk about the feeling of knowing or the feeling of knowledge, very often it really comes to play when we ask ourselves, do I know this or do I need to do more work on it? And very often we may think, we may be overly confident and think we know something when that's not really the case. And let me give you a really specific, I want to share something really specific where that really helps out here. Mm-hmm. This happens very often when we have what we are trying to study or what we want to know in front of us. So imagine studying with a textbook, or you know, if you are somebody using flashcards, remember you imagine having a whole bunch of flashcards in front of you. I don't know if you watched somebody use flashcards, Rob, recently, but if you take a look at somebody using flashcards, they will do the classic flip of the card, right? They look at the term on front of the card and then say, oh, do I know this? And then do a quick flip of the card to look at the answer and go, oh yeah, I know it. Well, that's exactly one of those very practical things you can avoid doing to make sure that your feeling of knowledge or feeling of knowing isn't skewed. Because if you have what you're trying to study in front of you, that artificially inflates your feeling of knowing. You think you know it more than you really do because you're not factoring in the fact that there it is, you can see it. And whether that's a flashcard that you've just flipped or your textbook sitting there, inflates the feeling of knowledge. You spend less time when you really should be spending more.
Talking to Regan Gurung about his new book. He's co-author, Study Like a Champ, The Psychology-Based Guide to Grade A Study Habits. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If there's something that's worked for you studying at high school or college, or learning to pass a professional exam, something on the job, something that worked for you, something that didn't work for you, if you're doing it right now, maybe you need some advice. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Regan, you looked at research that's out there that compared a lot of different things that can be, you know, many of which can be helpful. What stood out to you as the number one or two things that really pay off for study styles and methods?
Yeah, let's, jumping straight to the punchline, as it were. If you have time, your time studying is best spent testing yourself on the material. That's the number one finding across cognitive science, is that repeat testing or repeat practice, you testing yourself is one of the best ways that you can prepare yourself to learn. And this is in contrast to spending time rereading the material, even studying highlighted material or even flashcards. I mean, flashcards are useful. Studying key terms are useful, but not by themselves. The number one thing you can do is test yourself. The second best thing you can do, and I'll give you the top two, right? Because these are the two that are head and shoulders over everything else. Repeatedly testing yourself and spacing out your studying. And I think in the intro, you mentioned cramming. What cramming does is the complete opposite of spacing, right? Cramming is cramming it all into the night before the exam. The flip side, spacing it out, that's what's really good for you. And I love the way my co-author John likes to talk about it. He says, if repeatedly testing yourself and spacing it out were to date, they would lead to the really best way to do it, which is test yourself repeatedly, but spread out over time. And that's what's really going to get stuff from your working memory into your long-term memory, and you're going to be able to hang on to it much longer.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Rebecca is with us in Cottage Grove. Rebecca, hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to share my experience of going back to college in my 40s. I didn't ever have a college degree. I dropped out of college when I was in my 20s, and I always regretted it. And I always thought, I can do that. I could do that. And I never went back. I finally went back for a healthcare degree, which is a pretty demanding field, and I really had to learn how to study. And I just wanted to share how I did it. I actually graduated 4.0 top of my class, and I got a 97 on my boards. Yeah. And this is how I studied. So as an adult, you care more, right? Because you pay for your schooling out of your own pocket. So I wanted to study as much as I could, but I wanted it to be efficient. So I would tape all of my lectures on my phone and take notes in class, and then I would get home and I would rewrite my notes in outline form, and then I would listen to the lecture the next day on my way to school. And then in the end of the week on a Saturday, I would rewrite my notes again, but this time I would photocopy diagrams and color them in and label them. And then when I went to study, all my notes were perfection. So if I had to study, I had it all written two or three times already. And I kind of knew it all already, but I also made flashcards on my phone.
Wow.
Which now you can do in digital. So when I was sitting in waiting rooms, I would do flashcards. I was always quizzing myself. I would have people look at my flashcards and quiz me.
Nice.
I just did everything I could.
Rebecca, congratulations on going back, getting that degree, doing so well. I hear so much from your book there, Regan, spacing it out. She did that, you know, over the course of time with the same material. Go where you want with it, because she gave us a lot to work with.
Oh, and you know, I mean, Rebecca, that's almost a case study in some of the best things to do. And I just wanted to highlight a couple of different things in there. The biggest thing I hope everybody listening saw or heard is Rebecca did a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. It's not just flashcards. It's not just one thing or the other. The real bottom line with studying is the more you do with the material, the better you're going to learn it. The deeper you process it, the better you're going to remember it. And I have to underline one big thing in what you said, Rebecca, because it's a whole chapter in the book, and that's note-taking. Note-taking is one of the most underutilized study techniques. It is an actual study technique. It's not just capturing information. And your example of writing and rewriting and playing with your notes, that's just such a neat thing to keep in mind, because when we take notes, we are processing the material more, and you doing that multiple times helped you process it more. And wow, yeah, no wonder there was a 97 there. So good job.
Rebecca, thanks again for calling. We're talking to Regan Gurung, professor of psychology at Oregon State University, co-author of the new book, Study Like a Champ. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a story in your own life of effective studying or less effective studying, something that you thought might work but didn't, or you were pretty sure wasn't going to work and were proven right along the way, or if you're a teacher, if you teach people stuff, love to hear what you see in your students. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Regan Gurung, psychology professor at Oregon State University, co-author of the new book, Study Like a Champ, the psychology-based guide to grade A study habits. You can join in with your study habits, how they worked or let you down. Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Go back to your calls now. Bill is with us in Milwaukee. Bill, hi.
Hello, everybody. I taught writing and English for MPS for years. In fact, I founded the creative writing department at the High School of the Arts. I stayed in touch with many of my kids at the beginning, and the main reason they were able to succeed in college was that they were able to write. I spoke to the superintendent that making reading the top priority is wrong, because reading is passive. Writing is active. We work with journals. We wrote every day. In fact, when the head of the English
Continue
project did a, what do you call it?
I think I got you, Bill. Got some background noise there. But Regan, the value, I mean, especially with a subject like English, the value of writing and journaling and just constantly doing it.
And I think that nicely underlines the note-taking point, because when you're writing, right, you're really having your brain do stuff with the material. And, you know, definitely in creative writing courses and in English courses, but I think writing in any format is getting you to do things with the material. That's why, you know, whether it's writing an essay or writing notes in class, instead of just writing down what's on a slide, you know, push yourself to write about what you're hearing, write about what you're reading. And even if you don't have a writing assignment in the class, you writing and pulling thoughts together and material together is having you do stuff with that material that, again, helps you hang on to it more and brings out more, you know. And that's why I think I have to throw in this, you know, in higher ed right now, there's all this, you know, a lot of us are concerned about ChatGPT and AI and writing. And it's almost like as good as ChatGPT is, the soul in the machine isn't there. And when we write, you know, there's stuff that's the emergent properties of our different thought processes are coming together in a way that where AI isn't there yet, you know, which is why any writing in class, any writing to process the material is going to help you learn better.
Bill, thanks a lot for calling in. Diane joins us now in Elkhorn. Diane, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I had a daughter that was dyslexic. She was a very oral learner. And when she needed to learn something, I would sing it. I would put it in a song and she could learn it. I would sing her spelling words. I would sing her history facts. And now she works with a girl that has autism. And when she needs her to get dressed, she puts it in a song. And she has time to put on deodorant. And the girl sings, no stinky bits, no stinky bits. Anything I needed a child to do, if they wouldn't do it any other way, I would sing it. And oftentimes they would do it.
Diane, thanks a lot for the call. Whether it's singing or something else, Regan, I think creatively engaging with our material seems to be something that is going to help us.
Right, and beyond creatively engaging, what you see here is you're using more than one modality. So there's a more general term we call this dual coding. Whenever we're trying to remember something, if you can dual code it, where it's not just a word, but it's a word and music, or it's a word and a picture. To remember complex things, and in some cases, even things, you know, routines that you want to remember, if you can link something with either music or an imagery, it makes remembering certain things easier. And I think that's what we had here, was that it was almost a mnemonic device where that repetition yoked or tied to the melody helped, you know, recollection of it.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Regan Gurung, co-author of the new book, Study Like a Champ, The Psychology-Based Guide to Grade A Study Habits. Back to your calls now. Maddie is on the line in Milwaukee. Maddie, hello.
Afternoon. How are you guys? Great topic.
Thanks. So what experience do you want to share with us, Maddie?
Well, back to Rebecca, and I'm assuming it was nursing school. I also went back to school after having other degrees in my 40s, and at MATC in Milwaukee, I found an amazing instructor. Unfortunately, she's passed away, but she taught a learning strategies course that really opened up my eyes and made me realize what my strong suits were and how to really hold on to what I was trying to learn. And in nursing school, there's a lot of heavy material.
I bet.
And this learning strategies between auditory, tactile, which writing your notes, auditory by recording the lectures and re-listening to them, and then verbally saying things out loud as well. So I love what Regan is teaching, and I think the professors and the teachers out there have seen students struggle, and they're finding ways to give a lending hand any possible way they can, because our future is about education and people having passion in their work. And when you're struggling with test anxiety and so forth, that's when you start having people drop out of school.
Maddie, thanks so much for sharing that with us. Regan, the idea of a class in how to learn, I'm assuming you're on board with this idea.
Oh, absolutely. I actually teach a course in the science of teaching and learning where we go into it. And, you know, honestly, it's not even just the class. I think far too often, many of us, especially in college and universities, assume that our students know how to do this. And it's not that easy. There is science that shows you the right ways, but it's not necessarily what you would normally think of as being the right ways. And I think, you know, I'm a big proponent of it, no matter what class you're teaching, especially if it's a first year class or a second year class, take time out of class to talk about study strategies, to talk about the best way to go. Because both Maddie and Rebecca alluded to, you know, many medical terms and a lot of terms to memorize. That can be stressful, but the good news is a lot of these strategies, retrieval practice and note-taking and spacing, those are exceedingly good, especially if you have medical terms or a lot of content to memorize. So right on board with that, we need to be talking about this more and not assuming that people know how to do it.
Thanks a lot for that call, Maddie. Regan, I want to talk about big picture strategy. In one of your chapters, you talk about scheduling, having our plan of how and when we're going to fit these different study methods into our actual lives. Can you tell us, give us an overview of that?
Sure. I think one of the thinking about thinking and planning all falls into the jargony term metacognition. But metacognition, or really planning out your studying, is really the first critical step to establishing a good study pattern. And I think this becomes even more important when you factor in that a person may have 2, 3, 4, 5 classes and work and all of these different things to do. So when you plan out or schedule out when you're going to study, that makes it more likely that it gets done, because then you can visually note what all you have to get done and where. It's also important to actually walk the walk of some of these key practices. I mean, I may say repeatedly testing yourself is good, and I will say spacing it out is good, but it's very hard to remember to space things out and remember to repeatedly test yourself when you've got 5 classes and work. So starting with scheduling, and you find the way you want to do it. I'm old school. I love paper. You can use, you know, an app, but have a schedule of when you're going to do what, and that right there takes out some cognitive load, mental load, and it makes it easier to focus on what you have to do and when.
Regan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Regan Gurung, professor of psychology at Oregon State University, co-author of the book Study Like a Champ, the psychology-based guide to grade A study habits. If you have a lesson learned you'd like to share, you can still do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, join the search for some of Wisconsin's most majestic birds. Find out how you can get involved in the annual crane count. Now, a federal judge in Texas issued a nationwide injunction last week to reverse the FDA's approval of the abortion pill mifepristone. That drug was first approved more than 20 years ago. The U.S. Justice Department is appealing that decision, and Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call has joined a coalition of states challenging the injunction. Hours after the decision, a federal judge in Washington ruled in a separate lawsuit that the FDA can't pull mifepristone from the market in the 17 states involved in that case. Those include Illinois, Michigan, and Minnesota. The use of the drug for abortions in Wisconsin was already illegal under the 1849 abortion ban that came into effect when the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade last year. The two conflicting decisions make it unclear who will have access to the abortion medication. The issue is expected to end up in the U.S. Supreme Court. I want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the judge's ruling that would take mifepristone off the market? Do you think people should have access to the pill? Why? Why not? And what questions do you have about the legal decisions and arguments in these cases? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Susan Liebel is a professor of political science and Warren Research Chair at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be here.
We'll spend most of our time on the politics and law, Susan, and you're not a doctor, but can you remind us what mifepristone is and where it fits into the abortion landscape?
Sure. There are two drugs associated with medication abortions. There's misoprostol, and that is also approved by the FDA, and that causes contractions similar to a miscarriage. Mifepristone, which is the drug that's involved in these cases, is a second drug taken in this regimen, and it helps it helps with effects like nausea. So the two pills taken together are the most common form of abortion in the United States today, with a majority of abortions being medication abortions.
And medication abortions in states where they remain legal could still happen with that other drug, even in the absence of mifepristone, even though that isn't necessarily the first choice for providers. Do I have that right?
Correct. It would be a much more uncomfortable procedure with more cramping and more pain for the patient, but it is still possible
Let's get into this ruling now from a judge in Texas. Can you talk about the argument from the plaintiffs challenging the FDA's approval from over two decades ago?
Sure. I mean, this is a, I should say, this is a very unusual case with a very unusual argument and very unusual language. So normally in a case like this, we would see what we call like AP language, the kind of language that's used by newspapers in an attempt to be fairly neutral. Or they, and this usually means relying on terms that are used by, for example, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. What we see in this decision is language from the anti-abortion movement, terms like unborn human, use of the word chemical abortion almost 100 times, or abortionist. So it's unusual in that regard. And also it's unusual as to who brought the case. So normally you need standing to bring a case, which means that, you know, if I don't like a law, I can't just object to it. I have to have some sort of concrete injury. What's unusual about this case is there are no patients who are claiming to have been harmed. It is instead a group of people, a coalition of anti-abortion groups and doctors who are suing the FDA. And they're claiming that the FDA 20 years ago did not adequately review the scientific evidence or follow the protocols when it approved mifepristone in 2000. This is the first time that a court has ever suspended approval of an FDA-approved medication. And if the order goes into effect, it would, in fact, affect a large number of people.
In theory, a case like this could be filed in any federal court in the entire country. It was filed in this particular court in Texas, guaranteeing it was going to this particular judge. And people have been making a lot out of that. Can you talk about that part of the story?
Yeah, it's called judge shopping, and it's very common. Mm-hmm. It's done on both sides. You want to look for a jurisdiction that will be as friendly to your side as possible. So that's why we see the 17 attorneys generals going to the District of Columbia, the Eastern District in Washington State, and we see the coalition of pro-life people going to Texas. Matthew Kaczarek is the only judge in that district covering Amarillo. So he was the perfect shop because rather than it being a rotating number of judges, they knew that it would be only him. They knew that he had very publicly opposed abortion, and they could be pretty certain to have as friendly an audience as possible. So that's why they went there. I don't think we should ever talk about who appointed a judge. I think once judges are federal judges, they are judges. However, both sides do look for friendlier rulings.
Now, we've got this ruling in Texas, as you mentioned, the other ruling that seems to contradict it, at least in part of the country, coming out of Washington. That ruling from Texas stayed until this Friday. What's happening now?
So the judge has stayed his own order in order to give an appeals court the ability to step in. So when two district courts disagree, as they now do, one from Washington State and one from Texas, and it will go to an appeals court, and that increases the likelihood of this rising to the Supreme Court, where when there is disagreement among federal judges, you look to the Supreme Court to settle it.
What we can't predict the future. What kind of things could happen on Friday now? An appeals court could weigh in and do what in the short term?
Well, they can stay this. They can overrule it. They could issue an order. I think I'm not sure that I've adequately said just how unusual this case is. It's not about which side, but it is also just about elements of the case, the language and this idea of standing. So one thing that the courts could do is very narrowly say, I'm sorry, these people have no concrete harm, so therefore we dismiss with regard to standing. And that would be a way of de-escalating this. It's also possible that this will be decided by the appeals court and then be given a faster track to the Supreme Court.
Talking to Susan Liebel, professor of political science at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia, looking at abortion medications, a court ruling, an unusual one, as she points out of a federal court in Texas that would take one of the two main drugs used in abortions, in medication abortions, off the market. That would go into effect on Friday, but another ruling in Washington state contradicts that, likely to go to some kind of appeals. You can join in with your reactions, your thoughts, your questions about the legal elements here at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Susan, who is appealing this now? Or I guess, what are the various parties getting involved now? The federal Justice Department, I understand. We've got attorneys general in Democratic attorneys general around the country. Who now is taking this to court? How are they getting involved?
Actually, I haven't read all of that yet. But what we would see would be representatives from both sides making the case to the appeals court. So them looking at these two conflicting orders and making a decision from there.
If this decision stands, goes through the legal process, courts of appeals, the Supreme Court, what would that mean for abortion access to and this particular medication in states around the country? It would just be, I guess, gone?
There is something called enforcement discretion, which allows safe harbor for entities that are technically violating the law, but where enforcement is seen to cause more harm for public health than non-enforcement. So that means that the FDA could announce that it's not going to go after companies that are, you know, technically violating the law by manufacturing and selling mifepristone, as long as they're following what's called the risk evaluation and mitigation strategies, the REMS. And therefore, they'd be sort of maintaining the status quo. To be honest, Rob, I would be misleading everybody if I could say what would happen. Sure. I don't think anyone knows what's going to happen. And I think that that is why this case is causing so much consternation.
Sure. One concern that's been raised outside of the abortion issue is, given the unique nature of this, a judge saying the FDA got things wrong in their approval of a medication 2 decades ago, that this could open up challenges to other FDA decisions against any other medication. We've heard this from the Biden administration. What kind of precedent do you think this could lead to?
Oh, it's hard to exaggerate the outlandishness of the case, in that it is saying that anyone who objects to a medication that has been gone through rigorous trials by professionals without any harm, in other words, people with no standing to bring a suit, could just say, well, I speak for people who have been harmed. And there's a very interesting argument going on in the case in which it says, like, well, the women and the girls who have been harmed, they're not here, but that's because they're traumatized and they can't speak to their own concerns. And you know, to my ears, that raises issues of equal citizenship in terms of imagining that women can't bring a lawsuit when they are feeling harm. There's something odd going on there. It would open it up for anyone to challenge any medication. And I also want to underline, Rob, that the people bringing this suit, they are involved in challenging other rulings, specifically medications used for trans people. So even just in this case, what we're seeing is it is not just about medication abortion. And I also want to mention that mifepristone, it is used for miscarriages. Mm-hmm. So it also opens up really serious issues for the women who depend upon that medication after having experienced a miscarriage.
We're talking to Susan Liebel, St. Joseph University political science professor, looking at conflicting legal rulings on the abortion medication mifepristone. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the judge's decision on this pill used in abortions? Do you want to see it taken off the market? Why or why not? What questions do you have about what this all means, how it works in the courts? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Susan Liebel, political science professor at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. She's with us today to explore the legal future of the abortion pill mifepristone after a federal judge in Texas issued an injunction against the FDA's approval of the drug from 22 years ago. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this case, the judge's ruling? What do you think the law should say about mifepristone? Who should be able to access it? How should it be used? Do you have questions? Are you confused? If so, understandably, about how all this works in the legal and political system. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi, Susan. If I understood correctly, you are faulting us who are against abortions for lifestyle issues. You're faulting us for figuring fetuses are human. If that's accurate, then what are they if they're not human?
Dennis, thanks for the call. I think referring to our conversation earlier, Susan, issues of fetal personhood heavily debated, and the judge's ruling, I think, kind of went in that direction some. Do you have some thoughts on that, Susan?
Well, first, I just want to make clear that regardless of your position on abortion, it's possible to present bad science or false expertise, and it's also possible to make claims about standing that have never been used in American law. So I just want to make very clear that no matter where you stand, you should want the law to be well done. And you should want to follow the approach that many people who oppose abortion have followed. What's important about this decision is that it doesn't do that. So I just want to make clear, this is not about which side you're on. It's simply about how it is that we normally proceed. When we make a test case, test cases are usually clean. The plaintiffs have been injured. The injury is clear. And we don't have that in that case. So it's damaging to the rule of law when we're sloppy about how we bring a case. It's not the argument that we're making. You can make the argument in a more compelling way. That is not actually being done, in my opinion, in this decision and the opinion of other legal experts.
Thanks, Dennis. I will go to Sherilyn now in Delavan. Sherilyn, hi.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up, Sherilyn?
Well, first, the fact that this case was even heard is ridiculous because the plaintiffs have no cause in the case. No one was injured amongst the plaintiffs bringing it. But secondly, I am a scientist, I have sat on FDA advisory committees approving drugs, and I know the rigorous science that these drugs undergo. And it's just unheard of to me that a judge who has no background in science would try to overturn the hundreds of scientists who have weighed in and now the 20 years of experience that has shown that this drug should be on the market and has its uses and purposes. So I'm just appalled that a judge would try to overturn science.
Sherilyn, thanks a lot for the call. Susan, your thoughts?
Well, I think it's a very, very important point that Sherilyn raises about the protocols. And I want to make clear, if I haven't already, that the FDA did not apply its usual protocols. It went beyond its usual protocols. Even though this happened during the Clinton administration, there were a lot of politics in how the scientists were asked to do even more. There's a wonderful infographic available at the New York Times that links to the over 100 scholarly articles that have been written about mifepristone, and there isn't evidence that it is unsafe. So we have to be very careful. We can believe that the fetus is a person, but we can still have to show evidence for mifepristone to be dangerous to pull it from the market.
Sherilyn, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Susan Liebel, professor of political science at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia, looking at this ruling from a federal judge in Texas that would, effective Friday, take this abortion medication, mifepristone, off the market. Appeals in the works, a rival ruling out of the state of Washington. Not entirely clear what's going to happen over the next 2 days. And Susan, between now and Friday, what are you watching for on this?
Well, actually, you know, I've grown increasingly concerned as a nation that we agree on institutions, protocols, some of what Sherilyn was talking about in terms of how we define things. And I think what I'm looking for is our ability as a people to agree about certain kinds of requirements, things like standing. And I think it will be important to understand how conservative justices think. Sandra Day O'Connor was an extremely conservative justice, and whenever a case came to her, she always said, we should decide this as narrowly as possible, not as widely as possible, because as judges, we are not elected and we should move slowly. And so I think in this case, the standing issues would allow any kind of justice to at least pause and say there are issues with standing, let's send it back. And I'm sort of hoping to see that even people who disagree on abortion can agree on the rule of law.
On our concept of the judiciary and looking at it as an institution, we just had this Supreme Court race here in Wisconsin that hinged in many ways on the issue of abortion. The perception that one candidate would almost certainly rule one way and the other candidate would rule the opposite way. Do you worry that the perception in the public is that judges are the cliche is politicians in robes?
I do worry about it. I'm actually literally up at night worrying about it all the time. But I think that this the issue of judges is tied to, you know, wider trends in American politics. We have minority rule where we have majorities of people who agree on one side, yet we have gerrymandering, for example, and you're familiar with this in Wisconsin, that can produce what seem like majorities. And with the courts have always been a place where minorities went when they felt that they weren't being heard. I think what we've seen over the last decades is the politicization of appointments of judges. We've had the Federalist Society, for example, produce lists of approved judges, and we've seen Republican presidents using those lists. And I think that that has led to a sort of a ramping up of the politicization. And I do worry. I'm not sure about the Wisconsin race. It seems like what ended up happening there was, in a sense, a pulling back of the veil. Politics was already part of the race, and instead it just came out into the open. And I suppose, to be frank, looking at this Supreme Court, this is one of the most political courts there has ever been, and it was produced during strange political manipulations in that President Obama was not allowed to appoint somebody to the court because of politics, not because of the way the Constitution works. So I worry. I think all of us should take a step back. I think we should do our best to come together as much as we can on the rule of law, on things like what is the evidence for a medication being safe or not safe. Let's agree to what it is. And let's agree that if we've allowed the FDA to be that agency of professionalism, that we should allow that to stand and not make it political.
Susan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rob.
That's Susan Liebel, political scientist at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia, with us for a look at a pair of rulings by federal judges in separate cases related to the abortion medication mifepristone. There's some big audio news today. The Library of Congress announced the new inductees into the National Recording Registry. As usual, there's a lot of variety. The program highlights, quote, the richness of the nation's audio legacy and underscores the importance of assuring the long-term preservation of that legacy for future generations. Some highlights of this year's class, the oldest known recording of mariachi music from 1908 and 1909, a political analysis of the situation in Europe at the outbreak of World War II in 1939 by American correspondent Dorothy Thompson, the Super Mario theme song, and lots more music, jazz, pop, classical, and beyond, with artists including Queen Latifah and John Lennon, John Denver and Fletcher Henderson, There's a Stairway to Heaven and a Flash Dance, and the 1980s song that told us what sweet dreams are made of. Find out more today at 6 on 1A+. Check out the full list of the Library of Congress website. While you're there, nominate this announcement that I'm making right now for next year's list. You never know. This is Central Time.